The news about marijuana comes fast and furious these days. Oregon began allowing medical marijuana dispensaries just this month, while local jurisdictions on both sides of the state line move to greatly restrict where the dispensaries can be located, if at all, in a local jurisdiction. For example, the Weed City Council holds a hearing tonight on banning medical marijuana dispensaries, and today's guest plans to be there. Inga Frickland is actually a resident of Bend, Oregon, and a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. She is a lawyer, a JD, and a psychologist with a PhD in human factors psychology. A lot of her work is focused on improving efficiency and reducing errors in systems. For example, she designed and ran a program for managing parking tickets in Chicago that won awards. She's worked for cities, for courts, for the United Nations, for the military. You name it, she's probably done it. Inga Frickland, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Inga, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your current work with the Army and Marine Corps, what is that all about?
A lot of that is still related to their deployments into Afghanistan and is involved in helping them to learn more about the country so that they're better prepared for it. And certainly one of the issues that comes up is drugs in Afghanistan.
So here again, it's a chance to improve some systems just by improving how you communicate with the people who are the residents there.
So that people understand what's going on, how to deal with it, what works, what doesn't work.
You seem to be drawn to some places that certainly can be the center of controversy, if not out-and-out conflict. You've been to Iraq and Afghanistan and the West Bank. What's the general attraction for you?
I guess I go wherever places are interesting, where the problems look interesting. Though I think I've actually felt more personally in danger back when I was a prosecutor in Chicago, traveling around there in the middle of the night. I guess there are similarities around the world.
Mm-hmm. That part of your life, your time as a prosecutor, was over nearly 25 years ago. What was the primary focus? What kinds of cases were you prosecuting?
Oh, I did a wide variety of things. Drugs was a piece of it. And I also worked a lot in the bond courts, where people would come in the evenings or weekends to have bonds set after arrests. And I was struck by how many inner-city males, mostly black, some Latino, very rarely white, were in with some minor drug conviction, often several times. And you could just see that here are people who were, because of that arrest record, were never going to be able to get a legitimate job. And in effect, we were just cycling them back into the underground economy.
Was that the dawn of your feeling that perhaps the way we were approaching drug policy was not working?
Well, I think that might have been the start of it, though I think as most people back at that time, this was during the 1980s, were thinking, gee, drugs is bad, we need to arrest people. That's kind of the way it goes. But the evidence just kept accumulating that we were churning people through a criminal justice system at considerable disruption to their futures, their families, the cost to the taxpayers. And we weren't changing anything. Another part of my experience when I was a prosecutor was being assigned to work in domestic violence court. And that court could have been closed if it hadn't been for alcohol. Alcohol, not drugs, is what created all the knock-on family violence effect. But as we found when we tried prohibition of alcohol from 1920 to 1933, making the product illegal doesn't do anything to address the underlying problems. It just adds a lot of problems due to the illegality, including the crime, corruption, and violence. So for family court, drugs were a very minor issue.
So as a person who seeks to solve problems, to examine what the issues are that create certain situations, and as you mentioned, domestic violence court, having a lot of people there because of alcohol, did you make any proposals for what might have change that situation, even before we get to the drug part of it, just the alcohol part of it?
excuse me. Not so much specific proposals. There were things which are being done, and there is a fair amount of help for people with alcohol problems, which can be dealt with openly because alcohol is not illegal. It's a problem which isn't going to go away, but regulation of alcohol certainly keeps alcohol out of the hands of children. It gives quality and potency control over the alcohol content of different drinks. So there's no really solution that solves it, but regulation allows us to address the problem of alcohol in different ways and to try to at least keep a lid on it. We have denied ourselves that those possibilities with drugs because of the flat-out prohibition.
And you are a member, as we pointed out, of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We'll come back and pick up the conversation there about what might have pushed you over the line into the arms of LEAP, and then where LEAP stands on how things should go after prohibition. We'll come back with Inga Frickland and with your phone calls and emails as well here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the program in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about drugs and drug policy with Inga Frickland. She has been invited to come speak before the Weed City Council tonight, but proponents of medical marijuana dispensaries, which the Weed City Council is thinking of banning outright. There's a public hearing this evening. Inga Frickland is a resident of Bend, Oregon, world traveler, psychologist, lawyer. She has been to many parts of the world examining the effect of our drug policy on those parts of the world, and is now a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You can join our discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Inga Frickland, can you talk about the parallels you saw between your prosecutor days in Chicago and the things you saw in Afghanistan?
Well, being in Afghanistan, and between 2004 and 2012, I've spent almost 5 years on the ground there. And, of course, the war on drugs in Afghanistan was a huge issue for the American government. And what we saw when trying to track some of the drug trafficking networks in Helmand, which is the southwestern part of Afghanistan, which is the source of about 90% of the world's poppy, we would see these small, mostly tribal networks fighting desperately to protect their few square kilometers of turf. And anytime the U.S. Marines or the Army were in there, they would fight back. And it reminded me so much of the drug networks in Chicago, where here would be individual gangs tenaciously fighting to protect two or three square blocks of the drug turf. And it struck me that the way the two groups were acting was very similar. People simply trying to conduct business in a commodity for which there was a demand, and they would fight hard to keep anybody else out of it. The motivations and the actions looked very similar to me, half a world apart.
And as you pointed out already, in the situation in Chicago, you found people who were coming to court who were answering for drug offenses. And once those offenses went on their records, the chances of them getting a legitimate job, very limited at best. And so they probably end up sticking with that lifestyle.
They would. It was as though our arrests of them for drug offenses was diverting them out of a legal economy and chances for a future for them and their families, and insisting that they stay in an illegal underworld. We were creating problems, not addressing them.
So how long was the process for you? You mentioned that the experiences in Chicago were probably the beginning of your thinking that prohibition is not the way to go. Was it the kind of thing where you had thought a few things about this and then got to some defining moment that switched you around, or was it really a longer, slower evolution?
I think it was a combination, because I was working as a prosecutor back in the 80s and observed all the detrimental effects of the drug policies, but didn't really question them. I was thinking, hey, drugs are bad. Yes, obviously, we lock people up. And seeing how the increasing number of people in the U.S. had been locked up for drug offenses. And in fact, I saw in the Washington Post this morning, here's Attorney General Holder quoted as saying that we have something like a 20th of the world's population, but a quarter of the people who are incarcerated. So we are locking up an increasing number of Americans for what I see as no good reason. But I think it was my experience in Afghanistan that certainly crystallized my opposition to drugs. I saw DEA, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, going out to try to get Afghans to destroy poppy fields. And this is a population, Afghan population, of people who were very close to subsistence level. Statistically, about a quarter of their children will die before the age of five from easily preventable diseases. And here we are eradicating their poppy fields. And all this does is move the poppy from one place to another. We've essentially forced the government of Afghanistan to be a narco state because there is such a tremendous demand for poppy products from the West. Of course they're going to be grown. And since we've insisted that it be illegal, the only way they can be grown is with collusion with the local police authorities or the police actively involved in growing poppy. And the amount of violence and corruption, it's overwhelming the country.
I had a chance to read. I had a chance to read exactly what you're talking about here in an article you wrote back in August of 2012 called "On Drugs and Democracy," and I made a particular note on this part of it though. But what essentially what you're saying is we make Hamid Karzai and much of his government corrupt by our position on drugs.
Yes, I think that's what happens. Now, according to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, the ultimate street value of what comes out of Afghanistan is $68 billion. A few hundred million of that stay within Afghanistan. But the trade is all driven by demand in the West. And with profits that huge, it's going to happen. And just like during prohibition of alcohol back in the 1920s, when there is such a demand, it's going to be met by supply. Now, supply and demand, it really works. And if meeting the supply requires crime and corruption, that's what you're going to get. And my personal opinion is that one of the reasons that prohibition of alcohol lasted for only 13 years is that all the downside of prohibition came home to roost within the United States. It was our mayors, our police departments that became massively corrupt. So, and when we saw what damage that was causing, that was a powerful influence for legalizing alcohol. But with drugs, there's very little drug-related either violence or governmental corruption within the U.S. We've succeeded in outsourcing that. Most of the violence is taking place in the producer country, Afghanistan, Mexico, Colombia. If we had headless bodies piling up in suburban Weed or Ashland or Bend, Oregon, I think policies would change very quickly. But we've essentially forced other countries to bear some of the worst effects of our war on drugs. And I just have a real moral question with that.
If, in fact, then it's an issue of supply and demand, and you're talking about the supply keeping up with the demand from the West, then it would seem that the issue would then be how to address the demand, how to cut the demand. Is that and is that what your position is, reducing that?
Well, yes and no. Like, we aren't talking about reducing demand for alcohol. In fact, we have microbreweries all over the place. That's an important contributor toward the economies in both California and Oregon. What we are in favor of, what I personally favor, and, you know, Leap's position, is that we are neither for drugs, alcohol, and tobacco, nor against them, but say that these things exist, there is a demand. The best way to control is to legalize, which allows regulation. And that allows regulation of access, especially by children. It allows regulation and licensing in terms of both the purity and the potency of the substances. Now, during prohibition of alcohol, literally hundreds of people in the United States died because of adulterated alcohol. That's just not a problem anymore because it's regulated. And what we're seeing from use of marijuana, it's very hard for people who need it for medical reasons or who simply feel like smoking it to know what it is they're getting. There's also a problem with pesticide residues in it. And if it were possible to have marijuana legalized, it could be standardized, regulated, labeled by potency. We could be sure that there wasn't going to be pesticides involved. It makes it possible to control in ways that illegality does not. You can't control something which is illegal.
Inga Frickland is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a resident of Bend, Oregon, world traveler, lawyer, psychologist, and member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You can join our discussion about drug policy in America, the war on drugs, as it is called, and the end to that war that the members of LEAP would like to see. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Inga, you just did touch on this a bit, but I want to get a little further into it, because when you're against prohibition, you want to stop the current regime. But is LEAP very explicit about what kinds of regulations it would like to see and on which drugs?
No, LEAP does not have any particular position on what kind of drugs and what specifically the regulation should be. That is most appropriately something that the different states can work out. And as we've seen with alcohol, there's a wide variety of different arrangements. The common theme is that people are not prosecuted for it. It is legal to engage in trade in the substance. There's regulation of purity and potency. And you know, I think we're all watching the experience right now of Colorado and Washington State. We're gradually going to be finding out what works where. But by making something no longer illegal, it's possible to have different regimes of regulation.
Do you draw any conclusions thus far from the experiences in Washington State and Colorado? Granted, it's still pretty new there.
It's still awfully new, and it's only Colorado that's really gotten off the ground. I guess part of the surprise for everybody has been how much tax revenue they've brought in. And it's interesting to note that back in 1933, when prohibition of alcohol was finally lifted, that one of the important drivers of that nationally was the possibility of getting tax revenue, which did indeed happen. But the most immediate issue right now for both California and Oregon is having the availability of dispensaries. And I personally am a little puzzled about why communities would be objecting to this, because here are people, their own citizens, who already have a doctor's prescription for using marijuana. And these are people often with intractable pain due to cancer, to migraines, also PTSD, soldiers, men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Sometimes marijuana is the only thing which seems to help. And why would a community say to its own citizens, if you have an intractable problem like this that isn't dealt with in any other way, we don't want you here. Go elsewhere. And that's not a very thoughtful position. It seems very uncaring toward one's own population. And it seems so inappropriate to tell people with serious medical problems, you're going to have to go elsewhere. And there was a fascinating program on CNN 2 days ago with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who used to be opposed to medical marijuana, he has now made a 180-degree turn and is now promoting it. And he did a program that included a profile of some family from New Jersey, a two-year-old child with hundreds of seizures, epileptic seizures per week. The only product that stopped it was a variety of marijuana, which is grown in Colorado. The family literally had to move out of the state of New Jersey into Colorado in order to get what they needed, completely uprooting their lives.
There are those people who suggest, though, and I've heard it suggested by callers to this program and chiefs of police, that if you're serious about taking what is in marijuana and using it medicinally, why not just reschedule marijuana away from the no serious medical use category that it certainly enjoys at the moment into a place where you could actually extract the THC and deal with people's pain and suffering that way instead of having marijuana smoking going on?
Well, it would. One of the things that having it as Schedule One right now means that, you know, the medical profession finds it almost impossible to do research on this. Most of the research is being done in other countries because of the prohibition on it being done here. So we've willfully tied our own hands.
Right. So if you reschedule into Schedule Two, then you could do the research on it and potentially make an industry that would be, well, a lot less on fire, I suppose, to be quite blunt.
Yeah. Well, that would certainly improve matters, but that doesn't address the basic question, as we had under alcohol. Why are we prohibiting a natural substance, which many people want to use? Now, if people want to smoke pot, why not? I really don't see any federal or state interest in telling someone, you know, it's okay to come home after work and have a glass of wine, but you can't smoke a joint. So, and continuing with prohibition also means that most of the supply chains for something, especially coming out of the other countries, is going to be in the hands of criminals. The way to stop the corruption, the crime, the violence, the Mexican cartels, is to outright legalize, control it, make sure that children don't get their hands on it, which we have little control over right now. If people want to use pot recreationally, I think they should be able to do so. You know, just like it's possible to go out to one of our microbreweries and enjoy a beer along with a hot dog, as I did last night at the Weed Brewery.
You mentioned, and you have the benefit of living in Oregon, not terribly far from California, where both states are seeing municipality and county after county get onto a list. In Oregon, it's about three dozen local jurisdictions now that are trying to ban or at least strictly regulate pot dispensaries. In the legislature, yeah, they can do so for a year. Are there any specific circumstances that make Weed's case unique, since you're in Weed, California now?
Well, it's already been legal in other places. What it means now, I mean, the closest dispensary to Weed is in Mount Shasta, which is about 9 miles away on the freeway. In fact, I drove it yesterday to see what this was like. Again, the question is, why is a jurisdiction insisting that its own citizens, who have enough of a problem that they do have the legal marijuana card, are being forced to drive some distance away? Why the message that we don't want you here? We want to make life difficult for you. That just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And the experience in 20 states now have medical marijuana is that these businesses are just super anxious to stay on the right side of the law, which means not marketing to children, being very careful about their quality. These are legitimate businesses, and I really am not quite sure what it is people are so concerned about.
Inga Fricklin's
prohibiting is definitely sending a very negative message.
We will talk more with Inga Frickland, a resident of Bend, a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and we have a couple of calls and messages waiting. We will bring those to Inga's attention when we come back from a break. Back with Inga Frickland and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is drugs and the war on drugs and prohibition in the current sense, not the 1920 to 1933 sense in America. We're talking to Inga Frickland, who is a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I should remind folks who are just tuning in, Inga Frickland is a lawyer and a psychologist, worked in the prosecutor's office in Chicago, has been to Afghanistan many times over the course of the last 10 years or so, and has seen the effects of the drug war over there as well with the people who grow opium poppies. And we have an email here from Jim in Weed. He's your sponsor, reminding people that you're speaking at the public hearing tonight at 5:30 at Weed City Hall. The public is urged to attend. You'll also speak at an informational coffee brunch tomorrow morning in Weed at the High Low Cafe at 10 in the morning to take some questions from the crowd. We have some questions from the crowd here and now. Here's Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Inga Frickland.
Hi. Well, I've come up with two questions now as I was listening. The first one is about the private prison industry. I know that a few years ago, gambling casinos, amusement parks, and prison, private prisons were like the fastest growing industries, probably about 15 years ago, which to me was a sad reflection on our society. But I totally agree. You know, people who have addiction problems, you know, whether it be, and to me, we need to include cigarettes and alcohol and legal prescription drugs in the drug category. They're all drugs. You know, this is a physical and psychological problem we should be dealing with, not throwing these people in prison, you know, just creating a life of misery and hard to get a decent career and jobs and funding for college. I know if you're a felon, you can't get a loan, a government loan. And then I remember hearing, so that's one question, is how much does this private prison industry play into wanting to keep things illegal, to keep the prisons full, so that they create money, which to me is totally unethical and immoral. And then I remember hearing Native American activist John Trudell speaking at LCC a couple years ago, and he said the reason why marijuana was illegal is because of hemp. They wanted hemp to be illegal because, you know, the logging industry wants us to use trees rather than hemp fiber. So I just wondered if you could maybe comment on both of those or one of those, and thanks for your work, because I really do think it's... I have a family member who went to prison 40 years ago for drugs and, you know, LSD, experimenting, did some crazy thing one night, and it basically ruined his life entirely. He's now dead because he was afraid of being a part of the system because he had went to prison. And it really is... There's so many sad stories about people who did something that really in their mind wasn't illegal. They weren't trying to break the law. They were just making stupid mistakes in their youth, and it totally ruined their life. And I think it's really sad, all these stories. So thanks for your work, and I'll listen on the radio.
All right, Pam, thanks for the share and for the questions. Appreciate that.
Yeah, well, thank you. As to private prisons, you know, we have such a tremendous number of people locked up in the United States, and there are certainly a lot of people whose lives and businesses are profiting from this, which includes private prisons, all the people in DEA, police departments around the country, which are getting funding from forfeitures and from grants for drugs. We also have pharmaceutical companies. For example, Bayer Pharmaceutical has a monopoly on the legal
morphine products that come out of India. So I think anytime somebody is talking about opposition to legalization, one of my first questions is, what is their personal financial interest in it? And there are a lot of interests. Remember, this has now been illegal for 100 years. 1914 with the Harrison Tax Act was the first making drugs illegal in the United States. So we have a whole kind of interrelated culture of arresting people, locking them up, forfeiting their assets. Again, looking at this kind of from my systems perspective, there are a lot of things that feed into this. And I think a lot of pressure is against unraveling it. But ultimately, we have to ask, why are we creating criminals out of so many Americans who, either out of a matter of choice or, as the caller pointed out, simply doing something stupid, end up caught in the criminal justice system? So legalization and regulation, I think, is the main answer to that. But, yes, it can be an uphill battle.
And one of the pressures that Pam suggested, though, is that this idea that it's not that we want to keep marijuana illegal, that the powers that be want to keep marijuana illegal, but just don't want hemp getting onto the market with marijuana. Have you heard that before?
I have heard that. I don't really know how large an issue that is. I seem to recall that just like within the past couple of months, hemp cultivation has been made legal. You know, for all of these years, you could buy hemp clothing and other products in the United States, but it had to be grown elsewhere. Such as in Canada, which meant that our farmers could not grow it. And I really don't know whether or not there was ever any conflict with the timber industry, but I think, especially given the state of the timber industry in Oregon because of environmental issues, that growing hemp is yet another product that might help our economy.
There's an email here from... Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that I hope that the more we do that simply makes sense, the better off we are.
Here's an email from Tim in Eureka, Inga. He says, prohibition, been there, done that, not knowing history dooms us to repeat it. Let me add to that, though, because so often we hear from people who are staunchly in favor of the war on drugs, as it currently is constituted, that we're not talking alcohol, or we're not talking about social drugs that you can just sort of have as part of your meal or something, but something much worse. So if you would address the issue of, if we legalize, how we avoid a society in which people are walking around in a drug-induced fog most of the time.
I've heard it said that there's going to be a tremendous increase in drug use if it's legalized. I think the evidence is that that's not going to happen. And one of the things that I look at is corruption. During prohibition of alcohol, there was a tremendous amount of corruption among our police and elected officials. That's because in order for people to get their hands on what they wanted, bribing people was the only way to do it. Corruption is a very minor issue with our police and mayors right now. It's just highly unusual. That suggests to me that anybody who wants drugs right now is getting them without having to go to the trouble of bribing anybody. So it looks as though demand is pretty well being met right now out of the illegal economy. And in my own informal survey of high school students, when I asked, is it possible for you to get drugs? Their answer is uniformly, oh, sure, do you want some? People are getting it right now. But what they're doing when they're getting it is from an illegal source of unknown potency or purity. So I think it's there, it's just poor quality and connected with a criminal underworld. And we can remove those negative problems. And I think we'll be left with probably the same amount of drug use that we've got right now.
We have a call here from Phil in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Inga Frickland, a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Phil, go ahead.
Call here from Phil in Eureka.
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, hi. I'm enjoying your show. You know, Jeffrey, you ought to have it once a week. You should have an hour dedicated to this particular subject. It is so potent and so important. Two things I want to say is, number one, humankind, since the dawn of humanity, has once sought out drugs. Normally, I was told by a doctor, most people take one drug to go up, to speed themselves up and get themselves peppy, and one to go down and calm themselves down. This is going to
be
going on forever.
I've already had my first cup of caffeine.
Uh-huh, right.
right. And so this is not going to be a go away. But the reality is, there's marketing of ideas to the public. Whether you're selling a car or you're selling them on the dangers of cigarette smoke and what smoke will do to your lungs and cause lung cancer and so forth. If you want to legalize drugs, you're going to really have to have, along with that, take some of the profits that come from it or the taxes that come from it and create an advertising agency that advertises for generations to all the public in attractive advertising, mind you, letting the public understand reality as to what the drugs can do and the side effects and so forth. This has to go hand in hand. You can't just legalize something and leave people in the dark regarding one drug or another, because kids will look at other kids and these kids say, oh, it's great, you're going to have fun on this thing, we're going to go to the party. Well, you want these kids up front when they're younger in school to be blitzed with positive advertising regarding the dangers of drugs. And that was my most important comment I wanted to make, as the world will, and eventually, I assume, legalize a lot of it. Then the third thing is that one woman called you and called, it's an industry. When you hear the word industry, it means just that. Somebody is making a lot of money with the situation as it stands right now. And when they make a lot of money, they take some of those profits and they buy senators and congressmen and representatives to keep voting in their favor. That is what's going on as well. So you have a complex of events that's occurring that creates the situation you have. Only when something can bump something out of the motion can something else happen. It's laws of inertia.
All
anyway,
right.
I'll listen to the rest of the program. Thank you.
All right, Phil, thanks for your thoughts. Let's go to Priscilla in Neyland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Inga Frickland.
Hi. Although I understand various arguments on legalization, I'd like to point out one thing first about prohibition. Although prohibition did create a lot of criminal class over the generations, it also really did affect the amount of drinking in this country. My father, my grandfather, actually was a Teamster, and his job was to haul beer to dozens of local taverns on just about every corner of the street in the city. I mean, that's what he did. After Prohibition, there are people who get drunk, there are people who create accidents, but there was a whole lot less of it. So it's not that clear cut. And then the other thing I would like to point out is I live in a place where drug growing is, I mean, probably more people do than don't. And I have seen two cases where one woman who is high drove her car into a redwood tree and killed a 3-year-old and damaged her 5-year-old. And then there was my neighbor who drove with the kids hanging off of the roof of his car for fun until he sobered up. And it was just pot. It just affected his judgment badly. And then there was the guy down the road who my opinion is he took meth, but I don't know that. Anyway, he had a pot grow, and he had a couple of workers, and they had a labor disagreement. So he took a gun, and he handed through the woods and killed one of them hurt the other one. And I think that trial, I don't know if it's just finished or just going on. Anyway, but these are things that happen, too. So it's nowhere near black and white. And the fact is, if any of these people had been in jail, they might not have done the things they did. So I'm done. My rant's over. I was much affected by that child getting killed. I was on the road.
All right.
I saw what happened, and it was really ugly. And so that's all I wanted to say.
All right, Priscilla, thank you for those comments. Any response from you, Inga?
Well, let's see. To go sort of in, I guess, reverse order on this, yes, there are things that happen when people are high and are driving, not making good decisions. It's a considerably larger number of people that this happens with alcohol. And, you know, as one of the callers pointed out, the human species seems to be attracted to things that will have some consciousness-altering effect. So the question is, what's the best way to deal with it? And as the last caller said, well, if these people had been locked up, they wouldn't have been able to do anything. By that logic, we could lock up almost everybody, and then negative things wouldn't happen. So I think our best choice is regulation. There are laws on the books that govern driving while under the influence, and that in most places includes drugs, or including prescription drugs as well as alcohol. Those things should be prosecuted, and as part of education, to come back to the first caller's advertisement comments, enough publicity which was honest and accurate, which encouraged people not to drive after they'd been consuming, whether it was alcohol or some other drug, explaining to people what the health effects were, what impairment effects were. The publicity about cigarette smoking has dramatically dropped cigarette use over the years. And I think if various drugs were legal, it would be possible to have honest and accurate conversations. I remember back when I was young, older viewers, listeners may remember the Reefer Madness film.
Oh, yes. Much has been said about it. Inga Fricklin, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We have to call it close to it right here. Inga Fricklin will be at the Weed City Council meeting tonight at 5:30 at the Hilo Cafe in Weed tomorrow to answer questions like yours. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about a foreclosure assistance program in Oregon expanding. We'll talk to Rosie Perez at 9 o'clock about her handbook for an unpredictable life. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.